Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I'm going to be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine, all of them published in March 2025. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article from the health section of the magazine. The world's deadliest infectious disease is about to get worse. By retracting foreign aid, President Trump could make tuberculosis untreatable again. By John Green. Mycobacterium tuberculosis is a near-perfect predator. In 1888, Robert Koch, the physician who discovered the microbe, told a room full of scientists that it caused 1 in 7 of all deaths. In 2023, after a brief hiatus, tuberculosis regained from COVID its status as the world's deadliest infectious disease, a title it has held for most of what we know of human history. Some people die of TB when their lungs collapse or fill with fluid. For others, scarring leaves so little healthy lung tissue that breathing becomes impossible. Or the infection spreads to the brain or the spinal column, or they suffer a sudden, uncontrollable hemorrhage. Lack of appetite and extreme abdominal pain can fuel weight loss so severe that it whittles away muscle and bone. This is why TB was widely known as consumption until the 20th century. It seemed to be a disease that consumed the very body, shrinking and shriveling it. On a trip to Sierra Leone in 2019, I met a boy named Henry Ryder, whose mix of shyness and enthusiasm for connection reminded me of my own son. I thought he was perhaps 9 years old. The doctors later told me that he was in fact 17, his body stunted by a combination of malnutrition and tuberculosis. The cure for TB, roughly half a year on antibiotics, has existed since the 1950s and works for most patients. Yet in the decades since, more than 100 million people have died of tuberculosis because the drugs are not widely available in many parts of the world. The most proximate cause of contemporary tuberculosis deaths is not M. tuberculosis, but Homo sapiens. Now, as the Trump administration decimates foreign aid programs, the U.S. is both making survival less likely for people with TB, and risking the disease becoming far more treatment-resistant. After decades of improvement, we could return to something more like the world before the cure. Anyone can get tuberculosis. In fact, a quarter of all humans living now, including an estimated 13 million Americans, have been infected with the bacterium, which spreads through coughs, sneezes, and breaths. Most will only ever have a latent form of the infection, in which the infection-fighting white blood cells envelop the bacteria so it cannot wreak havoc on the body. But in 5 to 10% of infections, the immune system can't produce enough white blood cells to surround the invader. M. tuberculosis explodes outward, and active disease begins. Certain triggers make the disease more likely to go from latent to active, including air pollution and an immune system weakened by malnutrition, stress, or diabetes. The disease spreads especially well along the trails that poverty has blazed for it, in crowded living and working conditions, such as slums and poorly ventilated factories. Left untreated, most people who develop active TB will die of the disease. In the early 1980s, physicians and activists in Africa and Asia began sounding the alarm about an explosion of young patients dying within weeks of being infected instead of years. Hours after entering the hospital, they were choking to death on their own blood. In 1985, physicians in Zaire and Zambia noted high rates of active tuberculosis among patients who had the emerging disease, now known as HIV/AIDS. TB surged globally, including in the U.S. Deaths skyrocketed. From 1985 to 2005, roughly as many people died of tuberculosis as in World War I, and many of them also had HIV. In 2000, nearly a third of the 2.3 million people who died of tuberculosis were co-infected with HIV. By the mid-1990s, antiretroviral cocktails made HIV a treatable and survivable disease in rich communities. While a person is taking these medications, their viral levels generally become so low as to be undetectable and untransmittable. If a person with HIV becomes sick with tuberculosis, the drugs increase their odds of surviving dramatically. But rich countries largely refused to spend money on HIV and TB meds in low- and middle-income countries. They cited many reasons, including that patients couldn't be trusted to take their medication on time, and that resources would be better spent on prevention and control. In 2001, the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development had this to say when explaining to Congress why many Africans would not benefit from access to HIV medications. Quote, "People do not know what watches and clocks are. They do not use Western means for telling time. They use the sun. These drugs have to be administered during a certain sequence of time during the day. And when you say, take it at 10, people will say, what do you mean by 10? End of quote. A 2007 review of 58 studies on patient habits found that Africans were more likely to adhere to HIV treatment regimens than North Americans. In the mid-2000s, programs such as PEPFAR and the Global Fund finally began distributing antiretroviral therapy to millions of people living with HIV in poor countries. PEPFAR, a U.S.-funded initiative, was especially successful, saving more than 25 million lives and preventing 7 million children from being born with HIV. These projects lowered deaths and infections while also strengthening healthcare systems, allowing low-income countries to better respond to diseases as varied as malaria and diabetes. Millions of lives have been saved, and tuberculosis deaths among those living with HIV have declined dramatically in the decades since. Still, tuberculosis is great at exploiting any advantage that humans hand it. During the coronavirus pandemic, disruptions to supply chains and TB prevention programs led to an uptick in infections worldwide. Last year, the U.S. logged more cases of tuberculosis than it has in any year since the CDC began keeping count in the 1950s. Two people died. But in some ways, at the beginning of this year, the fight against tuberculosis had never looked more promising. High-quality vaccine candidates were in late-stage trials. In December, the World Health Organization made its first endorsement of a TB diagnostic test, and global health workers readied to deploy it. Now that progress is on the verge of being erased. Since Donald Trump has taken office, his administration has dismantled U.S. aid, massively eliminating foreign aid funding and programs. According to the New York Times, hundreds of thousands of sick patients have seen their access to medication and testing suddenly cut off. A memo released by a USAID official earlier this month estimated that cases of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis will rise by about 30% in the next few years, an unprecedented regression in the history of humankind's fight against the disease. The official was subsequently placed on administrative leave. Research on tuberculosis tests and treatments has been terminated, although the Secretary of State and Elon Musk have assured the public that the new administration's actions have not disrupted the distribution of life-saving medicine. That just isn't true. A colleague in Central Africa sent me a picture of TB drugs that the U.S. has already paid for sitting unused in a warehouse because of stop-work orders. Neither the State Department nor DOGE employees responded to requests for comment. Last year, roughly half of all international donor funding for tuberculosis treatment came from the U.S. Now many programs are disappearing. In a recent study on the impact of lost funding in 31 countries, one in four organizations providing TB care reported they have been shut down entirely. About half have stopped screening for new cases of tuberculosis. The average untreated case of active tuberculosis will spread the infection to 10 to 15 people a year. Without treatment or even a diagnosis, hundreds of thousands more people will die, and each of those deaths will be needless. By revoking money from global health efforts, the U.S. has created the conditions for the health of the people around the world to deteriorate, which will give tuberculosis even more opportunities to kill. HIV clinics in many countries have started rationing pills as drug supplies run dangerously low, raising the specter of co-infection. Like HIV, insufficient nutrition weakens the immune system. It is the leading risk factor for tuberculosis. An estimated 1 million children with severe acute malnutrition will lose access to treatment because of the USAID cuts. And refugee camps across the world are slashing already meager food rations. For billions of people, TB is already a nightmare disease, both because the bacterium is unusually powerful and because world leaders have done a poor job of distributing cures. And yet, to the extent that one hears about TB at all in the rich world, it's usually in the context of a looming crisis. Given enough time, a strain of tuberculosis may evolve that is resistant to all available antibiotics. A superbug that is perhaps even more aggressive and deadly than previous iterations of the disease. The Trump administration's current policies are making such a future more plausible. Even pausing TB treatments for a couple of weeks can give the bacterium a chance to evolve resistance. The world is ill-prepared to respond to drug-resistance TB because we have shockingly few treatments for the world's deadliest infectious disease. Between 1963 and 2012, scientists approved no new drugs to treat tuberculosis. Doing so stopped being profitable once the disease ceased to be a crisis in rich countries. Many strains of tuberculosis are already resistant to the 60-year-old drugs that are still the first line of treatment for nearly all TB patients. If a person is unlucky enough to have drug-resistant TB, the next step is costly testing to determine if their body can withstand harsh alternative treatments. The United States helped pay for those tests in many countries, which means that now fewer people with drug-resistant TB are being diagnosed or treated. Instead, they are almost certainly getting sicker and spreading the infection. Drug-resistant TB is harder to cure in individual patients, and so the aid freeze will directly lead to many deaths. But giving the bacteria so many new opportunities to develop drug resistance is also a threat to all of humanity. We now risk the emergence of TB strains that can't be cured with our existing tools. The millennia-long history of humans' fight against TB has seen many vicious cycles. I fear we are watching the dawn of another. That's the end of the article. The author, John Green, is an author and YouTuber. His most recent book is Everything is Tuberculosis. The title of his article, The World's Deadliest Infectious Disease is About to Get Worse. The title of our next article is The Global Populist Right Has a MAGA Problem. In Europe, Trump looks too extreme, even for many right-wing insurgents. By Helen Lewis. Nigel Farage loves Donald Trump. The 60-year-old's day job is as the parliamentary representative for the English seaside town of Clacton, and as a leader of reform, the latest of his populist right-wing parties. But Farage is often focused on America and his heavily advertised friendship with the 47th president. He was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration and chafing that he didn't get a prime spot in the Capitol Rotunda. He was also on stage last month at the Conservative Political Action Conference, joking to his American audience that, quote, you gave us woke, and we gave you Prince Harry. As the leader of a party with fewer than half a dozen members of parliament, Farage knows that his American profile gives him a grandeur he would not otherwise possess. In December, he posed with Elon Musk at Mar-a-Lago under a portrait of a young Trump in cricket whites. Days after Trump survived an assassination attempt in July, Farage flew to the United States on a mission funded by a wealthy reform donor. On his parliamentary financial disclosure form, Farage recorded the purpose of his trip as being, quote, to support a friend who was almost killed and to represent Clacton on the world stage. Lucky Clacton. But now Farage's embrace of Trump has become a liability. The 47th president is broadly unpopular in Britain, where Farage hopes to improve the 14.3% vote share he received in last year's election. He likely needs to at least double that proportion if he wants to be prime minister one day. Even worse for him, Trump's MAGA movement is seen as overtly racist and pro-Russia, two huge turnoffs for the majority of British voters. Even Britain's right-wing newspapers were outraged by Trump's shabby treatment of Ukrainian President Zelensky in the Oval Office, while Reform's existing voters are already outliers in their sharply anti-immigration views. Hitting further to the right is not a winning strategy in Britain. Or elsewhere, really. The populist right around the world has a MAGA problem. Sundar Katwala, the director of the think tank British Future, told me, there is a backfire effect in countries that aren't America. Key figures in Trump world, such as Musk and Steve Bannon, continually urge European populists to take more extreme positions on race, immigration, and cultural issues. Hardliners usually point to the success of the German far-right party AfD, known in English as Alternative for Germany, which placed second in the country's recent elections, its best showing ever. Musk had enthusiastically endorsed the AfD's leader, Alice Weidel, and he celebrated the result with a personal phone call to her. In truth, the AfD did not achieve the electoral breakthrough its leaders hoped for, although conditions were perfect for a populist surge. Germany's economy is stagnant, and a car attack by an Afghan refugee 10 days before the vote helped keep immigration at the forefront of the national conversation. The AfD struggled to gain a foothold outside the former East Germany. Other parties still refuse to include it in coalition talks. By dabbling in German politics, Trump World's second most powerful figure hurt his own business interests while being at best irrelevant to the AfD's performance. The party got nothing out of Musk's backing, Katwala told me. It transformed Tesla's reputation in Germany, but did nothing for the AfD. Ultimately, Trump's fundamental positions have limited appeal to most European electorates. His abandonment of Ukraine is so unpopular in Europe that Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and the French far-right leader Marine Le Pen, two natural MAGA sympathizers, have carefully distanced themselves from it. As MAGA becomes ever more extreme, allies such as Farage must decide how far to go along with it, in the knowledge that if they do not oblige, their domestic rivals will. The reform leader has just fallen out with one of his five MPs in a drama precipitated by who else? Musk, which played out on where else? X. Back in January, Trump's first buddy declared his support for the agitator Tommy Robinson, whom Musk credited with publicizing the so-called grooming gangs of men, mostly British citizens of Pakistani descent, who raped and trafficked girls in towns across England. But Farage recognizes Robinson for what he is, a rabble-rouser with numerous criminal convictions. When the reform leader repeated his long-standing refusal to admit Robinson to his party, Musk declared that Farage doesn't have what it takes. Musk's preferred alternative to lead reform was Rupert Lowe, a 67-year-old who used to be chairman of a soccer club. Lowe's day job is representing another English seaside town, Great Yarmouth, in Parliament. But his passion is posting on X. His disclosure forms show that he now makes about $4,000 a month from pumping out spicy takes on Musk's social network, and all the attention appears to have gone to Lowe's head. He recently told the Daily Mail that Farage saw himself as a messiah, and that reform risked being a protest party unless its leader surrounded himself with good people. By enormous coincidence, soon after the interview was published, Lowe was suspended from reform for alleged HR violations. Cast out from Farage's party, Lowe has since become even more extreme, a known side effect of spending too much time on social media. He wants the families of grooming gang offenders deported from Britain, not just men convicted of crimes, and perhaps even entire communities of British Pakistanis who he says have ignored the problem. The white police officers and social workers who might face the same accusation do not appear to bother him. Lowe claims that his party leader tried to stop him from expressing these views, an assertion that I instinctively believe. Farage, sometimes known as the father of Brexit, has succeeded in disrupting British politics because he knows when a dog whistle is preferable to a whistle. He has repeatedly forced out people from his various parties when their inflammatory rhetoric tipped into overt extremism. In 2018, he left the UK Independence Party after it appointed Robinson as an advisor. Farage has a winning formula, Katwala believes. Be guided by the British press. If the Mail and the Telegraph think the candidate has a racism problem, ditch them, he said, referring to two right-leaning papers. If it's just the Guardian, which leans left, you're fine. In the U.S., however, any such boundaries have collapsed. The breadth of permitted opinion, Katwala says, goes all the way out to the Proud Boys, the far-right group whose leader was jailed for his part in the Capitol insurrection and then pardoned by Trump. Voters outside the United States have one more objection to the MAGA movement. Trump and his allies talk about other countries in a profoundly alienating way. America first? Fine, but not America thinks your tin pot country is a joke. The toxic combination of Trump's pro-Russia leanings, Vice President J.D. Vance's arrogance and condensation, and Musk's sad case of advanced poster's disease have tanked Americans' reputation among its traditional allies. The exultant right-wing influencers who cheer on MAGA's sassy clapback anti-diplomacy should remember that insulting another country's politicians is like insulting someone else's family. I can be rude about my sister, but you can't. The Trump administration has revived almost every negative stereotype that Europeans have had about Americans. Too loud, too brash, too big. Vance, who lectures U.S. allies about how to run their affairs, reminds us of every rich guy from suburban Pittsburgh who visits the Amalfi Coast in the summer, drives up the pedestrianized streets, and then complains that the pasta is too chewy and there's no AC in his 15th century villa. As a result, even formerly bloodless technocrats have found new vigor when being picked on by the Trump administration. So far, the net effect of MAGA foreign policy has been to get exactly zero concessions from Moscow, while simultaneously reviving the fortunes of Canada's Liberal Party and helping the mainstream center-right win in Greenland. The new Prime Minister of Canada, the former central banker Mark Carney, was able to appeal to voters' patriotism when rebutting Trump's demand to annex his country and his punitive tariffs. Americans should make no mistake. In trade as in hockey, Canada will win, Carney said, after taking over the Liberal leadership from Justin Trudeau. The Liberals have been able to stop their opponent Pierre Poilievre's momentum by painting him as a MAGA lackey. A person who worships at the altar of Donald Trump will kneel before him, not stand up to him, Carney said. Friedrich Merz, the leader of Germany's center-right Christian Democrats, has been similarly energized. During a televised debate ahead of the recent German elections, he attacked the AfD for drawing support from the MAGA movement, painting his rivals as unpatriotic. The interventions from Washington were no less dramatic and drastic, and ultimately outrageous, than the interventions we have seen from Moscow, he added. Ben Ansell, a University of Oxford politics professor, believes that MAGA's sympathy for Moscow has given Europe's mainstream politicians a potent attack line. We may finally be witnessing the moment of hubris for the past decade's unstoppable rise of populism, he wrote in a recent Substack post. When mainstream politicians attack conservative populists, the latter can easily shrug off any criticism as the revenge of elites. Populists who actually side with an existing foreign enemy, though? Well, that clarifies matters. Now every decision the populist takes can be tied to the foreign enemy. In recent weeks, Farage's approval ratings have noticeably fallen. If you're being directly attacked by Trump and you have your own elections, it's hard to imagine being very successful in those elections by saying, "Yes, please," Ansell told me. Farage is plainly struggling to balance his desire to be close to MAGA with his domestic ambitions. Populist parties define themselves as being against the status quo and the mainstream, but many of their members and voters hold eclectic and divergent views on economics and other issues. These parties are more fragile than people have thought, and now you have this little lever that mainstream parties can use to split them apart. Their closeness to much-hated figures, Ansell told me. European voters have long been wary of Moscow's intentions. What's new is a sense that the people now running the United States have lined up with Russia and against Europe. Vladimir Putin has been around for a quarter of a century, Ansell said. It's Musk and Trump. Populists outside America might love the reflected glow of MAGA's power and success, but being linked to the Trump administration means tethering themselves, in the eyes of their home audiences, to an unpopular president, his unpopular celebrity advisor, his unpopular stance on Ukraine, and his unpopular bullying tactics. That is populist's MAGA problem, and the mainstream's opportunity to fight back. That completes the article. The title was "The Global Populist Right Has a MAGA Problem," by Atlantic staff writer Helen Lewis. I'll take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in March of 2025. This next article is titled, "What Trump and Musk Want with Social Security." The two maintain that they won't attack the program, but their repeated claims of rampant fraud serve a strategic purpose. By Laura Kelly. The idea that millions of dead Americans are receiving Social Security checks is shocking, and bolsters the argument that the federal bureaucracy needs radical change to combat waste and fraud. There's one big problem. No evidence exists that it's true. Despite being told by agency staff last month that this claim has no basis in fact, Elon Musk and President Donald Trump have continued to use the talking point as a pretext to attack America's highest-spending government program. Musk seems to have gotten this idea from a list of Social Security recipients who did not have a death date attached to their record. Agency employees reportedly explained to Musk's Doge team in February that the list of impossibly ancient individuals they found were not necessarily receiving benefits. the lack of death dates was related to an outdated system. And yet, in his speech to Congress last week, Trump stated, believe it or not, government databases list 4.7 million Social Security members from people aged 100 to 109 years old. He said the list includes 3.5 million people from ages 140 to 149, among other 100-plus age ranges, and that money is being paid to many of them, and we're searching right now. In an interview with Fox Business on Monday, Musk discussed the existence of 20 million people who are definitely dead, marked as alive, in the Social Security database. And Doge has dispatched 10 employees to try to find evidence of the claims that dead Americans are receiving checks, according to documents filed in court on Wednesday. Musk and Trump have long maintained that they do not plan to attack Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the major entitlement programs. But their repeated claims that rampant fraud exists within these entitlement systems undermine those assurances. In his Fox interview on Monday, Musk said, "Waste and fraud in entitlement spending, which is most of the federal spending, is entitlements, so that's like the big one to eliminate. That's the sort of half-trillion, maybe 600, 700 billion a year," end quote. Some observers interpreted this confusing sentence to mean that Musk wants to cut the entitlement programs themselves, but the Trump administration quickly downplayed Musk's comments, insisting that the federal government will continue to protect such programs and suggesting that Musk had been talking about the need to eliminate fraud in the programs, not about axing them. What kind of person doesn't support eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse in government spending? The White House asked in a press release. The White House's question would be a lot easier to answer if Musk, who has called Social Security a Ponzi scheme, wasn't wildly overestimating the amount of fraud in entitlement programs. Musk is claiming waste in these programs on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars a year, but a 2024 Social Security Administration report found that the agency lost closer to $70 billion total in improper payments from 2015 to 2022. Which accounts for about 1% of Social Security payments. Leland Dudek, a mid-level civil servant, elevated to temporarily lead Social Security after being put on administrative leave for sharing information with Doge, pushed back last week on the idea that the agency is overrun with fraud and that dead people older than 100 are getting payments, ProPublica reported, after obtaining a recording of a closed-door meeting. Doge's false claim about dead people receiving benefits got in front of us, one of Dudek's deputies reportedly said, but it's a victory that you're not seeing more misinformation, because they are being educated. Dudek did not respond to ProPublica's request for comment. Some 7 million Americans rely on Social Security benefits for more than 90% of their income, and 54 million individuals and their dependents receive retirement payments from the agency. Even if Musk doesn't eliminate the agency, his tinkering could still affect all of those Americans' lives. On Wednesday, Doge dialed back its plans to cut off much of Social Security's phone services, a commonly used alternative to its online programs, particularly for elderly and disabled Americans, though it still plans to restrict recipients' ability to change bank deposit information over the phone. In recent weeks, confusion has rippled through the Social Security workforce and the public. Many people drop off forms in person, but office closures could disrupt that. According to ProPublica, several IT contracts have been cut or scaled back, and several employees reported that their tech systems are crashing every day. Thousands of jobs are being cut, including in regional field offices, and the entire Social Security staff has been offered buyouts. Today is the deadline for workers to take them. Martin O'Malley, a former commissioner of the agency, has warned that the workforce reductions that DOGE is seeking at Social Security could trigger system collapse and an interruption of benefits within the next 1 to 3 months. In going anywhere near Social Security, in saying the agency's name in the same sentence as the word eliminate, Musk is venturing further than any presidential administration has in recent decades. Entitlement benefits are extremely popular, and cutting the programs has long been a non-starter. When George W. Bush raised the idea of a partially privatizing entitlements in 2005, the proposal died before it could make it to a vote in the House or Senate. The DOGE plan to cut $1 trillion in spending while leaving entitlements, which make up the bulk of the federal budget, alone always seemed implausible. In the November Wall Street Journal op-ed announcing the DOGE initiative, Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, who is no longer part of DOGE, wrote that those who say we can't meaningfully close the federal deficit without taking aim at entitlement programs are deflecting attention from the sheer magnitude of waste, fraud, and abuse that DOGE aims to address. But until there's clear evidence that this magnitude of fraud exists within Social Security, such claims enable Musk to poke at what was previously untouchable. And that completes the article, What Trump and Musk Want with Social Security, by Laura Kelly. The next title is Forever 21 Was Just a Phase. Farewell to a Beloved Purveyor of Trash, by Caitlin Tiffany. Forever 21 opened in my hometown when I was in middle school, when the opening of a new store at the mall was still a big deal. When the sign first went up, nobody knew what Forever 21 was. I remember thinking that it would be a store marketed to retirement-age women who felt young at heart. Forever 21. This was wrong, but not so far off. Du Wan Chang, one of its founders, has said he chose the name because 21 is the most enviable age. And it is, especially if you are 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, or 20, which are the ages at which I bought most of my clothes there. I can still smell the polyester and hear the white rabbits on the sound system. The clothes were, in theory, inexpensive versions of the latest trends. In practice, they were usually inexpensive versions of recently passed trends, and sometimes they were items so odd that they seemed to have been imported from a different reality. For instance, crop top with suspenders, Cheetos bathing suit. But for a suburban teenager, with a little bit of cash, the store still felt like a place of possibilities. Yes, Forever 21 was always a disaster. Its racks and racks of cheap merchandise were, quote, arranged according to surrealist organizing principles that were impossible for the amateur to comprehend, and much of what was for sale was hideous. But I did not have taste. What I had was an after-school job in the mall food court that paid $7.25 an hour. I received paychecks every other week of about $150 that I could, quote, save for college, or that I could spend on statement necklaces and bubble skirts. I think of that store fondly, and now it is closing. All of the Forever 21 stores remaining in the U.S. are expected to close as well. The company filed for bankruptcy this week, not for the first time, although this one is truly the end. We have been unable to find a sustainable path forward, given competition from foreign fast fashion companies, Brad Sell, the company's CFO, said in a statement. He also mentioned rising costs, economic challenges impacting our core customers, and evolving consumer trends. Forever 21 grew rapidly in the 2010s, opening hundreds of stores, many of them in enormous spaces, and reporting billions in annual sales. For a solid decade, Forever 21 was a common feature of the American landscape. At that time, finding a Forever 21 seemed as easy as finding a library. The highlighter yellow shopping bags were an indelible symbol of the excessively cool millennials' lifestyle. Some Forever 21 locations even became true destinations. For myself and many of my classmates, the four-story Forever 21 in Times Square was the most exciting part of our senior class trip to New York City. Not joking. Now the 20 and 30-somethings who learned to shop by wading through their local Forever 21 locations are mourning the brand and marking the end of an era. You can find many RIP comment threads right now in regional Reddit forums, where people often discuss their local malls. Most are lighthearted. I guess they turned 22. Nobody is in a state of shock, because there is obviously not a place in the culture anymore for something like Forever 21. Today's young people still like in-person shopping, but they like to do it in second-hand and thrift shops, or at the other end of the spectrum, in gorgeous stores that make shopping feel like an Instagrammable excursion. They still like fast fashion, too, but they like it faster than Forever 21 does it. Online-only brands such as Shine, Fashion, Nova, and ASOS can turn out hundreds or even thousands of new styles every week and sell them at unbelievably low prices. In the past several years, cultural awareness has grown about the reality of the fast fashion business model, which relies on paying factory workers shockingly low wages and takes a multifaceted approach to furthering the ruination of the planet. Barely used clothes pile up in landfills. Synthetic fabrics shed microplastics into the water supply. The manufacturing of polyester drives greenhouse gas emissions up and up. Today, young people shop fast fashion in spite of themselves. They know it's bad, but they're accustomed to convenience and limitless choice, so they do it anyway. Maybe the difference is that now they can buy it from their phone, which is less uncomfortable than looking at it all piled up around them in one physical place. When Forever 21 declared bankruptcy for the first time, 6 years ago, a retail consultant suggested something like this to the New York Times. Quote, "The emotional and physical aesthetic of it is not something that the current shopper wants as much, end quote. WSL Strategic Retail's Wendy Liebman told the paper, "You can't go home again, and it can't be 2010 again." As an adult, I now realize that the items I impulse bought at Forever 21 on my 15-minute breaks were, number one, contributing to human misery, and number two, not worth even the paltry sums I paid for them. I almost never got substantial use out of anything, either because the items were poorly made and fell apart, or because I quickly realized that they were ugly and unflattering. The only purchase I remember clearly is a dress I picked out to wear as a bridesmaid in a high school friend's wedding, for which I paid $12. I thought it was genuinely chic. I couldn't believe my luck, and I was impressed with myself for pulling a needle from a galaxy-size hayfield. But I wore it only once, and I suppose it is in a landfill now. There, it will last a long, long time. Not forever, but much longer than Forever 21 did. And that completes the article. The title was Forever 21 Was Just a Phase, by Atlantic staff writer Caitlin Tiffany. I don't really have time to do another article justice, so I'm going to read some answers from the Dear James column. This is an advice column in the Atlantic. The editor's note: is anything ailing, torturing, or nagging at you? Are you beset by existential worries? Every Tuesday, James Parker tackles readers' questions. Tell him about your lifelong or in-the-moment problems at dearjames@theatlantic.com. Here's one of the entries. Dear James, more than 20 years ago, when I went through a long-distance breakup while abroad, I didn't care about getting back any of my things. Yet my ex-boyfriend spent a lot of time and money packaging and shipping everything to my relative's American address. For a long time afterward, I remained too hurt, bitter, and poorer than him to even think about it. But now, all these years later, I feel like I should have contributed to the cost and should at least make the offer. I'm not sure why. Maybe the thought has crossed my mind because his children are probably going to start college soon, and the money, I figure, might be helpful to him. Or maybe it's because the causes we once both believed in seemed doomed today. They could possibly use some money, and he might donate what I send him. I mentioned the thought to my husband, who thinks it would look strange to make an overdue offer so many years later, especially because I didn't really stay in touch, except for a couple of emails or letters in the years immediately following the breakup. What do you think? Dear reader, I think this is a good idea. I agree with your husband. It will look strange. But so what? Better late than never is one of my go-to proverbs. And I'm always late, so I go to it a lot. Perhaps even more important than the money here is the belated acknowledgement of the effort your ex put into taking care of your stuff in the aftermath of your breakup. Whatever else went down, the rights and wrongs, the who said what, the foaming water under the bridge, in that respect, he looked after you. With even a certain dogged gallantry, you know all of this, of course, so go ahead and make it right. Rebalance this situation for yourself as much as for him. Blowing kisses to my debtors, signed James. About the author, James Parker is a staff writer at The Atlantic. And that completes the program for today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program. It's brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. The articles I've read were from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. All of them were published in March of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if there's a program that you missed and would like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website. On the first page, click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then on the second page, click on the words Podcast or Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.